The Guardian.
Hello everyone, happy new year from all of us at The Guardian Football Weekly. Where to start? Amazing game at the Emirates, another Stonewall penalty, a ludicrous finale and some wonderful football. Plus, should Liverpool let go of Coutinho? Have Palace drawn up a blueprint for how to stop City? And real insight into Claude Puel's Gilet. All that plus your questions, feedback corner, and that'll do for today's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Paul Hazell writes, who is sitting in Barry's chair?
Oh dear.
Priya Ramesh, how are you?
Good, thank you. Bit jet-lagged, but good.
Where have you been?
Singapore.
Okay, nice time.
Years. Yeah, it's good.
Was it okay? You're quite young. We've established. Did you see in the dawn?
Yeah, stayed up until 3 a.m. I think.
Okay, we must establish that you're in Barry's area, but we don't know where Barry's chair is, and we suspect he may have taken it with him for such occurrences where he's not on the pod. Lars, how late did you stay up on New Year's Eve?
Way too late. Can I just stress that I'm not in Barry's area?
No, you're not in Barry's area. No. You stayed up till when? Did you beat Priya?
Around about three, sounds good.
And what did you have for breakfast?
Today I had some couscous with a bit of tuna and some spicy sauce. Because I'm trying to be...
That's just the worst possible breakfast.
It's just not true. But I'm trying to sort of look after myself a bit more this year, being the walking cliche that I am. But I still believe in having a sort of solid breakfast because it sets you up for the day and it's a good weapon against snacking.
Is the reason you're going healthy because someone tweeted to say you look like... Theresa May's former advisor, Nick Timothy.
That's harsh. That's harsh.
I mean, I can't. It's just so on the money, you know. I can't deny it. It's embarrassingly accurate, and clearly something needs to happen. Also, my hair's falling off, and I'm thinking I can cope.
Not falling
with,
out, it's falling off.
Yeah, and I can cope with being slightly overweight or being bald, but I don't think I can do both at the same time. And one of those things I can like do something about, and the other one maybe not so much. So you know, diet, I guess.
Philippe Auclair. Bonjour, ça va.
Oui.
Last time you were here, you were about to do a gig, which was, I'm sure, a riotous success. It makes me think that you would see in the dawn with a cigarette and a small glass of red wine.
A large glass of red wine and fireworks there were, but in the garden, and we closed the ceremony at 4:30 in the morning.
Ah, beautiful.
Yeah, so that was pretty good.
To bring it back to sport, I was in the pub with some friends, and a guy came up to me and said, I recognise you. And... So you're like, yeah, you know, off the telly and all that. And then he said, are you Andy Townsend? Of course I said yes, and I had a photo, and it's nice to know that someone somewhere hopefully has put on Facebook, great to meet Andy Townsend, and it was me. But I think he's 10 years older than me. Sad time for me. Should we start then with Arsenal-Chelsea? This game was so good, Philippe, that I got off the sofa and I sat on the floor right in front of the telly like I used to do with He-Man. It was that good. Before we analyse any of the bits, do you just want to celebrate what a wonderful game of football it was?
It was, and I was at the Emirates, and I was one of the observer seats for once, so basically with the public, the crowd, and it's probably one of the very first times I've seen people not in the red action and or the clock end standing for the greatest part of the game.
And not
so
leave,
all the guys in the
leaving.
Press box were going, sit down, we can't see a thing. Well, you know, just stand up, guys, like everybody else. It was just an absolute cracker. And I had to go down a little bit earlier, just for a few seconds, to get ready to do the flash interviews after the game. And I was watching the very end of the game in the press room. And we were obviously, the images were about 3-4 seconds late. And suddenly I literally felt the table shake. I've never felt that ever at the Emirates, and I don't think it's going to happen very often. But it was just the crowd reacting to Hector Bellerin's extraordinary equaliser. Fabulous. Fabulous entertainment. Absolutely wonderful.
And great line from Jamie Carragher saying, after Bellerin was interviewed, I don't know if he looks or sounds more like Mickey Pearce from Only Fools and Horses, but it was a great line. Quite often, I think, Lars, you need brilliant games of football to remind you why you love football, especially I think when you work in it. So that's probably more for us than people necessarily listening to it, but I don't know if you would agree with that sentiment.
Yeah, and that was one of those for me, because I was planning on doing something else last night, and I was like, oh, I'm on the pod, I should probably watch this game. So I just brought it up on the laptop to keep half an eye on it, and it was just so engrossing you couldn't look away. It was just fabulous, and just the tempo and the overall, and there were so many like good plays, like moments when you're, oh, that's really good football, that. And, well, God bless Arsenal with this sort of, with the game against Liverpool as well being tremendous fun. This sort of Arsenal, and especially with, I think, the midfield pivot of Xhaka and Wilshere is a recipe for fun games, because neither are very, very good defensively, but they're quite good at build-up play and stuff like this. So I think you end up having really fun games.
My favourite moment, there were many, Priya, but Hazard took on about five players and then just did a little back heel or sort of roll back and took the entire Arsenal defence out of the game. And I just sort of emitted a groan, I suspect. There was no one else in the house with me. What was your favourite moment of that football match?
Actually, non-football. Well, it wasn't actually during a play of football, but when Sanchez went hard in on Fabregas, and then it was almost like Sanchez was going to burst into this fit of rage, and Fabregas just like embraced him and calmed him down. That was really kind of nice moment that within the chaos of it all, it was a very human moment between two former teammates and two, you know, very good footballers. And well, I mean, I don't have a particular moment, but I just think Cesc Fabregas was sensational. Mm-hmm. He is just one of my favourite players personally. And if you watch him off the ball, he's constantly scanning around him. And there aren't many midfielders that I've seen who do that.
Not Granit Xhaka, I can confirm.
So what about Jack Wilshere? Because
yes, it's terrific.
I've said this before. I've sort of felt with Jack Wilshere that now, whenever he plays a game, if he does a 10-yard pass, social media explodes with the fact that he's the greatest footballer on earth. And actually, I thought he had a brilliant game yesterday.
He did. And one of the things that he's bringing, obviously, is that somebody who drives forward constantly. And I think he's found also the speed for the first 5 yards that he had lost a little bit. And there were numerous examples. I mean, I won't say when he left Cesc Fabregas for dead, because that's not fair. Cesc can, you know, I walk faster than he runs. And he had these surges. And also he has, of course, this great, you know, a register, another registry, no, that's a Frenchism.
That's fine.
Of passes, basically, short, long, and so forth. And you can just look at this little hand that he's got instead of a left foot, and just enjoy the incredible suppleness of the ankle and the way he's able to manoeuvre the ball in incredibly tight areas. He was a joy to watch.
In fact, passing registry is almost a nicer way of saying it. You've coined a phrase that I will use now. Lars.
And he's very good. And I think it's important to point out that he's actually now played 90 minutes in 6 consecutive games. I mean, that's almost a bigger...
Which already qualifies him for a place in the England squad.
Well, I mean, that's almost a bigger story than him being good, because I don't think anyone doubts that he has this good level in him, but can he stay fit? And 6 games in a row is pretty good. And I understand why social media explodes, because I think in this country, if you look at the England squad the way it is now, there's such a dearth of this kind of guy in midfield who can control the tempo and who could set up chances and stuff. So I completely understand that the second he does anything useful, that the England discussion happens, but who else have you got?
No, you're absolutely right. And if he does that for the rest of the season, guaranteed starter. And producer Jonathan basically explodes whenever Jack Wilshere plays football. Okay, then.
And the good news, of course, for Arsenal fans is that it seems we're very, very close to going to the end of this contractual, to have the contractual situation resolved in the very near future. Mm. So Wenger confirmed last night.
Good stuff.
His goal was a rollicking finish as well. It's a brilliant finish.
Yeah. Although it was a little bit of close your eyes, hit it as hard as you can. Too harsh?
There's nothing wrong with that, though.
No,
absolutely.
I agree.
Exactly.
More of that.
Okay, let's get to the penalty decision.
Which one?
We'll go with we'll go with the one that was given, where Hazard was scythed down by by Hector Bellerin. I say penalty, Priya. What you say?
Yeah, I agree.
Lars?
Yeah.
Philippe?
Yep.
So there we are. So discussion over.
I mean, are you familiar with the term cognitive dissonance?
I think it's been used on this pod before. I mean, I work at TalkSport a lot, so
I'm
not used to that many syllables.
The tension and awkward feeling you get when you have two beliefs that you hold that are conflicting with each other somehow, and I have that big time on this one, because I've gone on about this on the pod before. This stuff that they talk about in this country about you're entitled to go down if there's contact and you're entitled to exaggerate, this is complete nonsense. You know, it is a form of diving, and I think what Hazard does there, for me, that qualifies as diving, because he's exaggerating to such an extent. But at the same time, there's no doubt Bellerin kicks him in the foot, and you're not allowed to do that.
So is it a foul and a yellow card?
I think that should be a thing. And I think the FA has a real problem here, because of the fact they did ban Nias, and the reasoning that they gave for banning Nias, and I'm reading from the report now. To the minds of the commission members, the movements of Mr. Nias's body, in particular the arching of the back and the collapsing of both legs, were simply not consistent with the amount of force exerted upon him by Mr. Dan, and in exaggerating the effect of the contact made between himself and Mr. Dan, Mr. Nias deceived the referee, and this led to a penalty being awarded. That's what they banned him for,
the
right?
The best thing is they use Mr. and no one ever uses that for any footballer apart from when they're in court.
Yeah. But the point is, this is what the FA banned Omar Nias for. Now, once you've opened that door, and once you've banned Omar Nias for that, the fact that they're not going to charge Hazard with anything in here becomes laughable.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't disagree. I was doing a radio show just
by
now.
By the way, just to add a little bit of fuel to the fire, I talked to Eden afterwards, and he admitted as much. It was very clear about that. But he said also, no, it was a pen. There was definitely contact.
But if he doesn't go, if he doesn't go down, he doesn't get the penalty.
Like, so that adds a third layer of confusion, which is another thing I believe very strongly, is I completely understand why the players do this, because the referees are terrible at giving fouls when people stay on their feet. they feel they have to go down because they'll cost their team
indeed
a penalty.
Who is it? It's Swansea, are you? When Lloris... I don't know whether he touched him or not, but if he'd gone down, Swansea would have definitely have got a penalty.
And I have actually spoken to more than one player who said this, that, listen, if I get fouled in the area and I stay on my feet, I will cost my team a penalty if I stay on my feet. And I can completely understand why they do it.
I think it touches upon a larger point of just consistency with refereeing and basically the rules of the game, which is something that Petr Cech touched upon in his post-match interview at West Brom. Because basically you're told something at the start of the season, and if referees don't keep to that standard themselves during the course of the season, then the players are, you know, confused themselves. And I mean, I guess players then do what they think will benefit their team, which, you know, in some cases may mean going down a bit exaggeratedly.
I mean, Wenger's got in trouble after the West Brom game. If you had to go on holiday, Philippe, alone or with Mike Dean, which would you choose?
I would really enjoy my own company.
That was a terrible that was a terrible decision. Yet some
that
people
said. My favorite story, I think, is Alexandre Dumas, who said, "How did you enjoy that dinner party at the Countess of so and so?" And he said, "Ma, I would have got really bored if I hadn't been there myself." And so I think no, Mike Dean, no, perhaps not.
It's very rare that Alexandre Dumas and Mike Dean are brought up in the same sentence
as well. That's what we're here for.
It was very interesting to see Petr Cech rage so much, because he seems like the nicest, sort of calmest man in the world. So I think we have a lot of sympathy with Wenger for that penalty rather than one in the Chelsea game. A few other things from the Chelsea game which we need to bring up. Morata's errant finishing, Philippe.
Yes, it shouldn't come as a surprise. I think it's always been thus, and it will always be thus. It's one of those weird things that he has those games in which he seems to miss absolutely every single chance, and others in which the hardest chances he converts with what seems to be ease. That's Morata. That's what you get with him. And to think he's going to change, he's, what, 25 now? 25, 26. And that's what he was already when he was at Real Madrid. It's a bit like Cavani, but he's not as good as Cavani. Is that you've got to accept that that's part of the package.
I think it's just he is still developing, and it's what Conte touched upon after the game, in that it's his first season where he is the main man. And this is the concern that many people had before the season started.
You have to rise to it, I'm
exactly,
just saying.
Exactly, and he has been good for Real Madrid last season and coming off the bench and being an impact sub and, you know, filling in for basically when the main protagonists aren't there. But in this role, it's almost like sometimes he just overthinks his movements. He doesn't quite, you know, go with what his instinct should tell him to do as a striker.
And actually a sign of incredibly good centre-forwards who, if they miss a chance, it doesn't bother them. And that's actually psychologically very, very difficult. Lars, Marcus Alonso, on the other hand, that's a brilliant finish. I mean, it's absolutely brilliant. He's got to move his feet so quickly. It's a centre-forward's finish.
I'm a big fan of him, and I'm a big fan of this idea that we write off players too soon. I mean, if someone hasn't made like the very top of their career and where they're going when they're 21, we tend to add that they must be a bit rubbish then. Like if they've ended up at Bolton or Sunderland or something, they can't be any good. We see from Marcus Alonso that you can improve, you can, players' development is a very inconsistent thing. And no, he's been very, very good for them. And you've got Zappacosta on the other flank, who's also an unlikely hero, I guess. It's good to see. Morata, someone made the point on Twitter, and I should perhaps name check him. Miguel Delaney of The Independent pointed out that a lot of these top strikers, they have this incredible single-mindedness. Like if they miss a chance, you can see they go into the next chance completely convinced they're going to score. And this is why a lot of them, I guess, are egotistical so-and-sos as well, because you have to have that instinct. And you wonder a little bit with Morata, if he misses a chance, it looks like it affects him a little bit. And he is famously, everyone says he's a very nice guy and all this. And I'm not, maybe he needs to be a bit more of a disagreeable character. He needs to be, basically, he's suffering from insufficient Bentner, is my theory. He needs to be more Bentner.
The futures of Ozil and Sanchez, Philippe, what do you know?
Not more than you do.
I can guarantee you do.
Oh, really? Okay. I don't think there's been any change to the situation. To be honest, you don't see them to staying beyond the end of this season. Leaving before that, Ozil, I don't think so.
He was brilliant as well yesterday.
He had an absolutely magnificent game. And I'm actually wondering, because he's had, over the last, 6 weeks, he's had some of his very best games for Arsenal. Again, physical sharpness, which sometimes has been lacking. Because sometimes, you know, people say, oh, he's not trying hard enough. Well, you might also be tired at times. You might not have the old, you know, the same zip and zest in the way he moves. He certainly had it on this occasion. But before I go further, I think you have got to say something if you don't want this pot to be shot down in flames.
Is it about Jack Wilshere shouldn't be on the pitch? Because we should say that.
No.
But we've done that now.
It's about what I thought was also a penalty on Maitland-Niles by Victor Moses. Mm-hmm. Because it's basically the same thing which happened. Minimal contact, but genuine contact. And the player had no choice. Well, it's not that he had a choice. The contact made the two feet, hit each other, and then he had to fall, and there was no penalty.
And we should also mention,
and it was a penalty,
Thibaut Courtois made an amazing save and was very good. And Petr Cech, who hasn't been brilliant recently, also had a very good game. Priya, your hand is up. How polite.
And actually, that save that Courtois made, where he basically tipped Sanchez's strike onto the post, and then it kind of went behind him, it was very similar to perhaps what is Petr Cech's most famous save in the Champions League final, when he saves Schweinsteiger's penalty and he tips it onto the post. And he's talked about it in interviews, where he's basically trying to stay as still as possible so the ball doesn't hit him and go back into the net.
Will Chelsea, ins and outs at Chelsea before we move on to Man City? David Luiz?
Yes, David Luiz, very much on the exit.
Do you think he might join Arsenal, Philippe? That's been something that's been written about recently.
I do not know about that. It might be a little bit expensive, perhaps, for the Arsenal to play like that. And Michy Batshuayi, as well, as we know, is on his way out too. So these two.
It was reported last night after the game that Conte told the Italian media that I rarely get the players I ask for. I always seem to end up at clubs where there are austerity projects going on. Which I think...
Hashtag pray for Conte.
I mean, that's a strong thing for a sitting manager to come out with in the middle of a season. So maybe he's trying to tell the owners there that, you know, I'm a bit annoyed.
But
he looks like he's probably going at the end of the season anyway, doesn't it? So.
But in that sense, it makes Chelsea not to indulge in every wish that he makes, because if he's going to be gone anyway, I mean, why not just look at the long term and get a player who, you know, would fit into many other managers' visions? But I mean, also the point I wanted to make is, if Chelsea do get Alexandro, they can convert Marcus Alonso into full-time striker.
True. And Chelsea in long term, and not words I've necessarily put together too often. Manchester City march on, but since we last did a pod, they didn't win a game. Crystal Palace held them. There was a penalty in the last minute that Palace missed as well.
I was there. My favourite game of the
really?
Of the festive season. I absolutely loved that game.
And tell me why.
To bits. Because I saw an incredibly brave performance from Crystal Palace, and brave in every single sense of the word. I mean, I would put aside the Jason Puncheon assault on De Bruyne, which was very much out of context, basically. No, I mean, I for once you saw a team which had prepared properly, had a genuine plan against Manchester City, and executed it absolutely perfectly. and which confirmed all that we had known or guessed since Hodgson came has come to Crystal Palace. It's just perfect for this type of players. Who are not top players, excuse me, sorry, but who are actually talented group, which is a bit, reminds me a bit of the Fulham group that he had. So you have some, you will have Zaha, who is obviously perhaps above the others, but you have Milivojevic, who is excellent, Kabay, Townsend, you carry on like that. He's got a lot of good players, just like he had Dempsey and Davis and Zamora and Murphy, and he can...
Hangerland,
of course.
That Zamora chip against... Was it Zamora? No, Dempsey's chip against Juventus.
Dempsey's chip,
against Juventus.
My favourite moment in the history of football, personally.
What a great goal that was.
And he's done very well. And it's the bravery of it, because they didn't park the bus. They didn't do that. They were pressing high at times when they needed to. When they did it, they did it very well. And when they attacked in numbers. And they had identified some areas where City were perhaps vulnerable. And no, they were absolutely magnificent. And I think that, by the way, I don't think Pep had anything to say about the result. That's absolutely fair, despite 75% possession. Nothing unfair about it.
I think Crystal Palace have only lost once in the last 11 games, which is very impressive, that loss to Arsenal.
Best series since 1990, isn't it? Or 1991, something like that.
Yeah, but it's just really impressive considering, you know, I mean, even under Deborah at the start of the season, they did have good numbers underneath the you know, pretty poor performances. But I think Hodgson, credit to him, has come in and turned, you know, the fortunes around, to us, to borrow a cliche. And it was just...
And without Scott Dan and without Mamadou Sakho, so with a sort of makeshift defence, and that shows that you're doing things properly in training when you're setting your defence.
Mm. They also won at Southampton, didn't they? On City, Gary Neville was on the telly last night saying he doesn't think City will run away with things like this next year. I mean, I know they haven't won the title yet, but they basically have. Because he was saying the other teams will just build and build, but the way you watch City at the moment, you think... You can see him doing it again.
Next year is an interesting test because there's so many people saying that, well, obviously Man United are nowhere near because they've only spent 300 million or whatever it is. Presumably Man United will have the chance to spend more in the summer, so that excuse isn't going to wash next year. So you'd think it would have to be closer, but it's really hard to do anything about them when they're winning these many games. I mean, it just is.
Manchester City also beat Watford, who are struggling. Were the proper football men right about Marco Silva?
Who are they?
I think writing people off after being smacked around by Man City, I mean, you're going to end up with very few people who...
I don't know, but they're on a poor run. Ever since Everton got interested in Marco Silva, and I don't know if that's anything to do with it, their run has been pretty poor, Watford, including that defeat to Swansea where they shouldn't have lost, that will be.
There have been some poor results. They also, unless I'm mistaken, they have a good number of injuries at the moment throughout this run, and... I don't know, they're in that big chunk of players, the big chunk of teams between 10th and 18th who are basically have the same number of points, and that's roughly where Watford are at their level, I think. So, I don't know, I wouldn't be pulling the emergency disaster brake just yet.
Pep said that we're killing the players because there's so much football. Yep. Do we agree with Pep?
Yep.
There is a there is evidence to suggest that players do get injured a lot more in this particular period. You see things like hamstring injuries go up quite a bit, and he does have a point in as much as we're maximizing, you know, basically human potential in a particular very compressed period of time.
I spoke to a player a couple of years ago who came to England from a league on the continent, who said the trouble with not having a winter break is that I'm used to just really pushing myself until Christmas. You know, you have the first half of the season, and if you have a small niggle, you play through it. You know, if you start feel tired, you just grit your teeth because you know there's a couple of weeks break coming off where you can go and have therapy and you can go and you can just relax. But when you get to England, you push yourself towards Christmas and then suddenly you have twice as many games in just no time at all. And it's really difficult to deal with.
Philippe, can you think of a way to solve it?
I can think of ways to manage it because you don't want to lose that. It's one of English football's, you know, greatest traditions and selling points. So there's no question it's here to stay. What I found was totally over the top this year was the fact that so many games were postponed or pushed back 1 day, 2 days, just for the benefit of television, with the I was talking to with one of the guys from the Premier League who goes to games, you know, from PLP, and he told me he'd done 9 games in 10 days, which is totally ridiculous. This should never happen because it creates an imbalance as well. Mm-hmm. Some teams do have less recuperation time than others. We shouldn't go into, you know, particular examples because it varies from 1 year to the other. So there is absolutely no conspiracy about that. It just so happens that sometimes you will have 48 hours, sometimes 72, sometimes, you know, 96, whatever. And especially if you're a small club, a small team with a smaller squad, bloody difficult to manage.
True, but look,
Thing is, like, for example, we've got Boxing Day 26. Why don't we play all the games on Boxing Day? There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. And actually, probably it will add, I think, to the tension, because I couldn't, you know, to be honest, even yesterday I was thinking, oh, that's the 22nd round. Yes, that's the 22nd.
True.
Which day are we? We must be Thursday.
Yeah, the TV would argue that they spend a lot of money on it, and that means teams get these wonderful players that we all love to watch. That's the converse argument.
It's a balance. For example, the fact of putting the Arsenal-Liverpool game early by 24 hours, you could live with that. That's not a big problem by putting it forward. But then afterwards, to stagger the games over such a short period, that's completely ridiculous. Honestly, that's ridiculous. And also, not everybody, there's another imbalance because there's actually a kind of mini break right now. Yeah. But not everybody is going to be benefiting from that. So you're going to punish the teams which are going to take the FA Cup seriously and who are in the semi-finals of the Carabao Cup. You're going to punish those for being good at what they do. That's not on. It's just a question of managing time rather than saying, oh, do away with it.
What about each player is only allowed to be played 40 times a season? So you've got to manage your players. It encourages youth players coming in. I mean, it's a daft idea, but it's just a suggestion.
That's a bit of a strange idea. I mean, it would be far more than 40 for starters.
Okay, 50, I don't know, 45.
Well, you also end up with the situation which people seem to get very excited about in this country, where teams rotate for specific games. Like, they take a game and say, if you're Stoke, probably not going to get anything away at Chelsea, just put up whatever team, and then you focus on the next one. When you do that in this country, people go mad. They seem to not like that at all, even though it's a very reasonable thing for me, certainly, to just try to get the most out of your
resources. It's reasonable unless you lose at home to Newcastle,
but
I guess, isn't it?
I'm not sure I agree with that, because you've still tried to give yourself the best possible chance of winning that game, and just because you lost it, that doesn't mean that was the wrong thing to do.
Okay. No, you're right. Spurs beat Swansea on Tuesday. They play West Ham tonight. There was more refereeing controversy in this game. Davinson Sanchez probably should have been sent off. Llorente was offside. I guess Son could have had a penalty. Dele Alli could have had a penalty if he was sort of pushed over very softly. But that would have been a straight red. But how much fun, because it was so wet, Priya. I want more games like a mud bog. You don't see them anymore like that.
No. I'm pretty sure you just enjoyed Llorente in the rain.
There is that as well. I mean, who doesn't? What are our thoughts on Carlos Carvajal? And also, he was at Sheffield Wednesday. He was Carlos Carvajal the whole time, and now he's gone to Swansea. He's Carlos Carvajal, and I'm lost, and I don't know what I meant to say. Priya, your brain is huge. well, we know it is. Sorry. Sort of just like Doogie Howser, you know.
I have a pretty small head.
You do, but a giant brain. It's extraordinary. Can you tell me what I meant to say?
Well, his Wikipedia page says Carvajal.
Hang on. In Wikipedia, I was a member of the BNP and going out with Louis Walsh at the same time, which is difficult to balance those two up.
We need some proper lusophones to let us know. If you say Carvalho, you should say Carvajal.
Yeah, Carvajal.
Surely.
So, okay. Anyway, more importantly, what do we think of his appointment? What do we think of him, Lars?
I think it's always as sort of slightly alarming when a club seems to actively go for managers who are out of work. Just this idea that you don't have to pay a fee for them is a priority. That seems very strange to me, because it's such a big decision for the club and there's so much on the line. And then he's got a very difficult job there, because it doesn't, from what you hear, it doesn't seem like they're going to invest much in the market, and I think their squad's pretty poor, so odds are that they are probably, I'd be very surprised if they didn't go down, and so since he's done all right at times in the championship with Sheffield Wednesday. I guess maybe the idea is that you can get them out again, but I don't know.
Would anybody like to praise Harry Kane with a temperature of 380 million, cutting back and playing a beautiful pass to Dele Alli for that goal?
Absolutely glorious, yes. Yes, indeed. Not the first time he's done it this season. I can remember another one about 3 weeks ago. One of those glorious cross-field passes.
Oh, it's a Son, I think. Yeah, yeah, you're right. So they play West Ham.
He has now scored fewer goals this calendar year than Shane Long, which has got to be a cause for concern.
Yeah. That's a very good line. West Ham, who Spurs played tonight, had a big win against West Brom. Andy Carroll for England, Priya.
No, just a small stat on Swansea, okay. Who they sold Lorente, Sigurdsson and Jack Cork in the summer, and all three have scored against them so far.
That is a good stat.
For their new clubs. But West Ham, Carroll for the first half was basically anonymous. He didn't really impose himself on the match. It was pretty, you know, they may as well just played with 10. But it is just, he just has that ability to, you know, power himself up and tower over defenders and send a header into the back of the net. Inevitably, he's gonna go to the World Cup now and, you know, lead England to glory. But right. No, I'm just kidding. I'd actually rather focus on Arnautović for West Ham, who's
Please
been
do.
Tremendous since Moyes took over. His general attacking output has gone up quite a bit. He's being more involved and he's just imposing himself a lot more on the game, and for someone who came under fire
back.
A lot.
He tracked back to block a cross, which I don't think he'd have done at the start of the season.
Are you sure of that?
I believe so. I'm not sure. he's done really well.
Does it not almost make you a little bit angry to see how good he is now? Like, because whenever he has a point to prove and he's motivated over a prolonged period of time, he looks brilliant. He's got so much going for him.
I think the difficult thing is that there are many things to be angry about in the world, and the early season attitude of Arnautović just, it doesn't make the top 10 for me.
But certainly from West Ham's perspective, if you've got him and Andy Carroll sort of lurking around the box and you whack a lot of crosses in there, you're probably going to score goals. And for a team that's in a bit of trouble, it must be great to have weapons that are so difficult to counter.
West Brom won the first two. No wins since then. No wins for Alan Pardew.
Yep. What a surprise, eh?
So I have to think of this, because West Brom have been pretty terrible. I do wonder about this when you have a team that's, the squad is really put together in order to play one way. I mean, Pulis, yes. Say what you want about Pulis, but he knows exactly what he wants from a squad in terms of the way they're going to play, how they're going to do things. I think it's then really dangerous to get in a manager who wants to do something completely different. And you do, especially when you do it mid-season, because in England, you don't get a lot of time on the training ground to begin with because there's so many games. Especially this time of year, you have almost no time on the training ground to work on anything. Right. And you bring in a guy who wants to do things different to what the squad was put together to do. And I was thinking, if your midfield is Jakob Krychowiak in Livermore, odds are you're not going to play very good, expansive passing football because that's a midfield that's put together to stop the opponent. And if you tell him to play football, you're probably not going to be very good at that.
It's not that bad, you know. Krychowiak, I rate quite highly.
But is he not more of a destroyer, though? So,
yeah, they're three destroyers, absolutely. Yes. It's a fleet of destroyers.
that's what it is. And if you ask them to do something that isn't destroy, odds are they're not going to be very good at that. So I don't see that working very well at all.
Before we finish part one, and a sort of sad way to finish it, but Jake Livermore, obviously the reported abuse that he got from the West Ham fan. Yep. I mean, we don't need to say anything apart from it's a complete disgrace and, you know, a ban from that. Life stadium bans, I've just got a funny feeling that they don't work very well because I'm sure you just go in another turnstile. But look, credit to him for not reacting, and it's just a great shame. And I don't know what you say, Philippe. Like,
no, I don't know what to say,
because
I don't know what to say.
I think it's hard for fans around to report abuse like this.
That's the one thing I don't think. That's, you know, when people are going to say you're a grass or something like that.
Yeah, and then
I mean, that kind of thing, you must be joking. That's not the kind of level zero of insults that we get in.
No,
I mean, that stands everywhere. But this is genuinely. It's just unbelievable. Yeah. It's now, verbal assault.
A lot of people around the fan are saying he didn't say that. But if he did say that, you're absolutely right. There is a line and he crossed it. But yep. Stewards don't get paid very much money. That's also, you know, it's a very difficult situation. It's one of those things where you say there's a lot of money in football. Is there a way, a solution I don't have it, but hopefully there can be one. Anyway, look, that's part one. In part two, we'll begin with Liverpool. Welcome back to part two. Let's start with Liverpool. Philippe Coutinho, who knows what's happening? Representatives going to London. Will he go now? Will he go in the summer? Will he not go at all? Will it be £200 million? Philippe.
I have to say that everything I've been hearing has been, and for a while has been, very consistent. And usually when you get those kind of wild rumours, you know, floating about, they don't tend to be that consistent. And in this particular case, the figures that are being quoted, which is namely £133 million, which I suppose is €150 million, is something that I first heard quite a while ago. I think, like everybody else, when I saw the amount of money that they were prepared to pay for Van Dijk as soon as this January, I thought, somebody's bound to go out, because FSG don't work by throwing money at people. So there's got to be somebody on the way out. And I was wondering, I was thinking it's either Coutinho or Sadio Mane, because Sadio Mane looked a little bit unsettled at that time. It was not quite the happy Sadio that we love. He was finding scoring a little bit more difficult.
Happy Sadio is a nice
happy Sadio,
nice
yeah.
ring to it, doesn't it?
And as far as Coutinho is concerned, I think that it would, Liverpool fans might not agree with me, but I think it would make a lot of sense. I don't think what's so wrong with Liverpool parting with Coutinho for €150 million, because he's not. They've got a player called Adam Lallana coming in. Okay, he's not Coutinho. Sorry, he doesn't have the technical ability of Coutinho and so forth. But he's a vital player for Jurgen Klopp. He will bring a lot of things that Coutinho cannot give to the team, particularly in terms of defence, up the pitch and pressing and so forth. Coutinho has scored loads of goals, loads of assists, but so have everybody else. People have been throwing, you know, like numbers, like he scored like a zillion goals and zillion assists over the last 3 or 4 games. Yes, but they've won all these games by 5-6 goals to nil. And everybody has got fantastic figures at the moment. Is he as influential on the way that Liverpool play? I am not so sure. When he was away, you remember that at the beginning of the season, we saw some great performances from Liverpool as well without Philippe Coutinho. And when you've got an offer of that magnitude, which gives you the opportunity to address the real problems within the squad, you think, hey, I'm going to have this. And they're going to be bloody dangerous, because it's not just going to be Van Dijk. You could perhaps imagine perhaps a keeper coming in, a proper defensive midfielder addressing the imbalance in the team. You lose a great player, lovely player, beautiful player, but you don't lose the soul of your team.
I think absolutely. If you think about some of the big sales that Liverpool have made, the ones that have really impacted them, maybe Xabi Alonso moving and then Luis Suarez, and they struggle a bit after losing such, you know, key players. But I honestly don't think Coutinho's going to leave that much of an impact on the side, because, I mean, as you mentioned, Philippe, they've already got Adam Lallana returning from injury. They've got Naby Keita coming in the summer.
Absolutely.
They've got Oxlade-Chamberlain, who still, you know, can put in a shift in midfield and produce both in attack and, you know, in defence. And as you said, they've now got the opportunity, if they sell Coutinho, to go and address the real problem areas in defensive midfield, and getting a proper kind of person to shield the defence and perhaps, you know, prevent the defence leaking very easy goals. And that would then obviously allow Liverpool to go forward with a lot more aplomb as well.
It's obviously frustrating for a fan when you see a magnificent player like that leave your club, but I completely agree with what you're saying. They still have this wonderfully balanced and excellent attacking three with Mane, Salah and Firmino, and then you just basically need to put together a midfield that makes sense behind them. And Coutinho, as more of a number 10, it's never been completely obvious to me, even though he's played wonderfully, if he's an integral part to that long-term project they have there, and it gives them a lot of money. And I guess Liverpool fans, the same way that Southampton and RB Leipzig fans have had to accept that, you know, Van Dijk and Naby Keita are moving on in their careers, you know, Coutinho will be doing the same. And that's just the natural order of things, I guess.
I mean, just to actually illustrate what I was saying about the fact that how much did they suffer when he was not around? Well, okay, at the beginning of the season, they played 4 games without him. The only game they lost was against Manchester City, when they actually had the better of the game until Sadio Mane was sent off. And then afterwards it fell apart. They do that. And apart from that, they'd beaten Arsenal 4-0 without Coutinho. Then he was also away after the game against Spurs, which he played in. And they won their next two games 3-0 and 4-1. So
he's hopeless.
So well, no, it's not that. Not. And then he was on the bench against Stoke and they won 3-0. So it's not the question no. of the games that he's missed this season in the league. They won every single one. Apart from the Watford game, which was crazy, the first game of the season, and a defeat to Manchester City. The others, they won in by large margin. So he's not as influential, perhaps, as people would think he is.
So you're Liverpool, so you don't have an oil state funding you. You don't have a Russian oligarch. You don't have the sort of worldwide marketing phenomenon of Manchester United. So you do need to keep an eye on your bottom line more so than the teams you're competing with. And you have a chance to sell a player who is amazing but isn't 100% integral to your team, and you can get 160 million plus for him. You kind of have to consider that, I think.
Moving on, another story off the pitch, slightly more disturbing. Daniel Taylor did a brilliant interview with the England and Liverpool youngster Ryan Brewster, talking about the amount of racism that he has experienced on the pitch, both from fans and both from opposition players. His kind of almost... acceptance that it's going to happen, and the pointlessness of standing behind a kick it out, a let's kick race them out of football banner, lack of some inaction from FIFA, the FA, to their credit, said they're going to look into this and have spoken to FIFA. But it's interesting how mature, I mean, I think about how immature I was when I was that age, you know, incapable of a sentence, and how maturely he comes across. But also what a disappointing state of affairs it is that he's saying what he's saying.
Yeah, and bravery as well, because it was his decision to go to the Garden, wasn't it? I mean, with his family, so which means obviously he's also somebody who's got a surrounded by very good people. Mm. Anyway, I think everybody's heard about Ryan Brewster at Liverpool is that they absolutely love him in every single way. He's very mature and very fine player. One thing that I mean, it was sickening to read this, and it was also what was good is that he was quoting what was told him, because very often, you know, people say he was said, you know, he was told horrible things. Well, we know what he was told. That's absolutely disgusting. Mm. And there is a case, and I think it's been made by a couple of players and ex-players, to say, right, it's about time that all this window dressing with all this respect campaigns and this and that by UEFA and FIFA, you forget about it. Don't take part into it. Don't do it. Punish the culprits. Punish the clubs. Do it properly. And then we can start, you know, try to educate, of course, at the same time. But there's got to be action before all these wonderful ads where you see all these faces. It doesn't talk to people who behave like that. They don't give a monkeys about it, if I can say so. I mean, that's horrible, because it's exactly what they would say. Hmm. That's exactly what they would say.
I mean, as sickening as it is, as, you know, a person of colour reading it, it is also very relatable, because, I mean, there are incidents where people just say words without even understanding what they're saying. For them, it is just a word, and it's a way to get to you. I don't know for what reason, but how he described it relates, and it goes a long way to, you know, basically describing how many, many people of colour feel when they're treated that way, which is just one word or one phrase that will haunt you for the rest of the day, for the rest of the night. He talks about how he can't sleep at night because he will just be replaying that incident over and over again. And it's happened to me, and it is a very real thing. And I completely agree in terms of, you know, basically the whole organisation of football needing to do something about it, because, as you said, there's no point in dressing, you know, this as an initiative, you know, kick it out and having players stand in front of, to their credit, kick it out are also an organisation, who deal with this very well. But I mean more in terms of UEFA's kind of advertisements, and I think he mentions it in the interview as well. It's very ironic that you're standing around a stadium with billboards that say no to racism, and on the pitch you're, you know, subjected to this kind of treatment.
Yeah, I'm well brought up, because Troy Townsend, who you know, runs Kick It Out, done some work for them, does tireless work, and actually, you know, constantly trying to bang down the door to change things. And I mean, you wonder how, well, it's not easy to change things, is it? It's not easy to change society, but yeah,
I'm also wondering if it's, I would imagine it's compounded in his case by the fact that there has been genuine progress in in England, that nobody can say that there hasn't been genuine progress because of all these campaigns, also the work done by FSF, for example, education, the clubs having a zero tolerance policy, and they do, and they put it into practice. And then you're subjected to that when you go out of this little uneasy bubble, so to speak, and then you're confronted with this sheer violence and racial hatred. And I mean, the guy's 17 years old.
Yeah. It's very frustrating. It is to move away from that.
And then we're going to Russia, right?
Yeah. On the pitch, Liverpool dug out 2 wins, away at Burnley, home to Leicester. Ian, for a big gear change, Lars says, what are the plus points and pitfalls of Claude Puel's gilet? How does it compare to a normal coat? What on earth is he up to?
I tracked this down on the Uniqlo website. It's a down jacket that you can get for, like, I think, 30-odd pounds. And it's basically a vest, but, like, it keeps you warmer than normal kind of
A puffer waistcoat.
It's a thing in France, by the way. In my family, I was back in my family for Christmas. Everybody had those puffer jackets. Well, not jackets. They're very thin and very warm.
Burnley haven't won since Christmas. They did get a good draw at Old Trafford. Well, they were 2-0 up in that.
Word on Liverpool, actually. That win against Burnley felt quite significant, actually, because that is the kind of game that they've thrown away so many points under Klopp. So the fact that they actually got it at the last minute was, I think, quite significant to their season and the momentum and just everything. Burnley, there's going to be an element of regression to the mean there. That's the only thing that makes sense.
Here we go. Burnley.
Let me just say, but they've not, like, they've not won in 5, but they're not playing too badly. And you lose to Liverpool and Spurs. If you're Burnley, that's going to happen. I guess 0-0 against Brighton and Huddersfield is kind of worse for them, really, but they're still having an amazing season, so good luck to them.
Manchester United, that insipid draw against Southampton. Then they won at Everton. Before we bang on about Jose, I have a question, Philippe. Jesse Lingard, is he good?
Of course he is good.
How good is he?
Well, I didn't know he was that good. And I think most people didn't know he was that good. Honestly, I mean,
going back to
what Lars was talking about, late developers. Mm-hmm. He's no longer a young, you know, puppy coming out from Carrington's academy. He's not no longer that. First of all, he's given a run of games that makes a huge difference in a role that he enjoys in a team that is physically very imposing and where, you know, you've got to give Mourinho his due when not considered everything he does is wrong. In this particular case, he's looked at him and decided, this guy can actually do a real job for Manchester United, and so he has, which is why now we're talking about Jesse Lingard as well, joining the plane for Russia instead of Andy
Sitting
Carroll.
Sitting next to Andy Carroll and Jack Wilshere. Jose said, Lars, talking about Paul Scholes, the only thing Scholes does is criticise. He will be in history as a phenomenal player, not as a pundit.
I always feel like it's a bad sign when manager starts having to go at individual pundit. That reeks of weakness to me. I mean, really, you're the manager of one of the biggest clubs in the world. You shouldn't care about what some guy on the TV says. I mean, you're so much bigger than that, or at least you should be. Remember that time when Spurs were playing against Tromsø in Norway and Andre Villas-Boas got really angry at like one person in the crowd who said something mean to him? That kind of was the moment I realised that this fella's going to get sacked real soon. But no, honestly, I thought the second half against Everton was really good. I mean, United, that was a big half for United in the context of their season. It was one of the 40 minutes of football when we really saw like what they're trying to do. I think Pogba playing in a role that's much more suited to him on the left in a 4-3-3, I think he's much more comfortable there than
closer to what he was doing at Juve.
Much closer, absolutely. He's got Matic sitting at the base and he's got Herrera sort of roaming about. I mean, I think that's a good balanced midfield that makes sense for them. I think that was, again, like Liverpool against Burnley, I think that was a big half of football for United in the context of their season. And I mean, you can't call it a turning point because we don't know, but I think suddenly they looked a lot like more like the team I think Jose Mourinho wanted them to look like.
Which makes it weird that he then goes out and is still grumpy, doesn't it? They've played well.
Paul Scholes had a point, and it is precisely his point that was proven right in the second half, because Pogba did play with that much more freedom, and as mentioned before, he's a bit more similar to what he did at Juve, and he reminded me quite a bit of Frank Lampard in Jose's initial reign at Chelsea, in having that freedom. It's just sitting in front of two other midfielders and being able to make runs either side into the box and drive play through him. And I also think word out to Luke Shaw, because his runs constantly down that left side allowed Pogba to move into space and play him through as well. But precisely, Paul Scholes had a point, and because Jose addressed it, that's why they did that so well against Everton in the second half.
Jose owes Paul Scholes everything. No winning four.
I would also point out to the fact that one of the better performers recently, even when Manchester United haven't been brilliant, but he was playing in that game and he had a very important role, was Juan Mata, who is, the one
that
guy...
strike that hit the post was lovely, wasn't it?
Yeah, he's a player with... He's got a much quicker brain than any of the people around him. And he's perhaps the only one in that Manchester United squad to think like that quickly.
No win in four for Everton. Before we move to the few other teams we haven't mentioned yet, some good news, Philippe. We put some money on the 225 at Wolverhampton.
And
Surrey Blaze came in first. So party time at our house. Stoke make up the relegation places at the moment. We mentioned Hughes resting players, and then look how happy you are, Philippe.
I can't believe it. I had him at sevens.
What do you have on that?
I had a fiver, and then I put another fiver when he was at five.
Stop it. Magical news, Billy.
So drinks are on me after the pod.
We mentioned Hughes resting players and losing hopes in Newcastle. Very quickly, I'll go to just you on this, Priya. Is he going?
Well, managers have been fired for a lot less. You think about some of the other sackings this season, and he does seem to have survived this absolute... Well, I don't want to be too harsh, but Stoke have been quite abysmal for a while now. And they really haven't provided much either way in terms of defence or in attack. If I'm not wrong, they haven't scored in any of their last in four of their last six games, which, you know, shows that they have issues all over in terms of recruitment, in terms of not having the right players, and Hughes just isn't getting enough out of them. And you know, I think a change might not be the worst thing for Soak.
Priya, Lars, we've lost Philippe now because he's just so giddy with winning 30 quid on the races. Southampton on the slide as well. £100. Stop it. Shane Long did score a goal. Pressure on Berahino now as to be the goal drought king.
Or as of a French commentator put it in his live commentary, which I absolutely loved, he called him Bernard Hinault.
Bernard Hinault. Oh, yeah. He'd be a film star if he was called Bernard Hinault. Huddersfield, they drew 0-0 with Burnley, lost 3-0 to Leicester. Next game's against West Ham and Stoke, which could be telling. And the only sides we haven't mentioned are Brighton and Bournemouth. They drew 2-2. So now we've mentioned you, please don't complain. That'll do for part two. In part three, a bit of Football League, your questions, feedback corner, and then we'll all go home. Welcome back to part three of Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Breaking news is that Everton have signed, is it Cenk Tosun from Beşiktaş? Can anyone tell me how good he is?
All my Turkish friends say he's bloody good, and they're very sad to see him go. I don't watch enough of the Super League to tell you much more about him.
Okay, well, we'll find out when he comes over. And Priya, you wanted to just to mention for David Silva that we hadn't mentioned about wishing him the best, because the son born very prematurely. And you also had some trivia. You've got a question for us to guess.
Yeah, can you guess basically out of all the four English divisions, 92 clubs, which club comes right at the bottom for calendar year, given now we've established calendar year stats are a thing?
If it is not Sunderland.
I'm going Sunderland.
Birmingham.
It is Sunderland.
Yes.
But not bad. Birmingham are 90th. Coming in at 92nd is Sunderland with 32 points. And the only side currently in the Premier League are West Brom, 89th, 35 points all year.
We might as well talk about the Football League then. Wolves are flying in reverse. Sunderland opened up a 12-point lead at the top of the Championship. They won two more games last week against Bristol City and Brentford. Derby are second. Well done, Gary Rowett. Cardiff are third. Terrible festive period. They lost four in a row, I think. Bristol City fourth. Villa fifth. And Mark Warburton was sacked by Nottingham Forest after 9 months in charge, following a 1-0 defeat at worst in the calendar year club Sunderland. You were mentioning in the little break, Philippe, Hull and Sunderland struggling.
Yeah.
Two sides that went down, which is quite interesting.
Yes, absolutely. Usually, I mean, normally you would think that the parachute payments are so, you know, large that they would prevent you from falling even further deep. But that's not the case with them. And even actually looking at the bottom five of the championship at the moment, you also see two other teams which not that long ago were in the Premier League, i.e. Bolton Wanderers and Birmingham City. And it seems that going back up is not always as easy as Newcastle and Burnley have shown it to be the case. Can I mention something about Leeds United?
Absolutely, Philippe.
Yeah, something which is quite interesting is the fact that they've just got into this partnership with Aspire in Qatar. And I, to be honest, I was a bit surprised with that. But looking further into it, it appears that one of the people, we should have seen that coming, one of the people who's been put in the board of directors is Ivan Bravo, the former sports director of Real Madrid, who miraculously after Qatar 2022 visited Real Madrid in 2009, so just before the vote, found himself bombarded director of Aspire just after that visit. And it seemed there is something going on there, and I'd be very interested to see what the Leeds United fans think about this, because they have, you know, obviously the new owners have done a lot of things absolutely right, and fans are much happier than they used to be against under Chelino. But this is a move which I think should be looked into with a little bit more, perhaps a bit more caution.
All right, interesting.
It's an interesting one. Personally, I didn't see that coming at all.
Into League One, Wigan are still top. Their cushion is reduced to 2 points after Shrewsbury won their last two and Wigan drew 0-0 with Charlton. In League Two, I went to the Western Homes Community Stadium to watch Colchester 0, Cambridge United 0. Would you like a full report on this?
By all means.
Virtually nothing happened. Well, I say that Colchester could have been 7-0 up at half-time and it could have been 7-0 at full-time, but the positives about this place is its proximity to the A12 and very near a McDonald's. Otherwise, you've got to be careful when you move to a new stadium, right? Layer Road and, you know, those old stadiums like Kenilworth Road, like the Abbey, the Cambridge Stadium, you know, great old, dirty, proper football stadiums. This was so soulless, and maybe because not a lot was happening on the pitch and it was very cold. But I feel for the Colchester fans. And I chatted to quite a lot of them on Twitter about how sad they are that there's not even a pub anywhere near them now. You've got to get a bus to the nearest pub. It's not what League Two football should be. Congratulations to Preston North End's fullback Kevin O'Connor, who won €1 million in the lottery in Ireland. Isn't that a lovely story? His uncle bought him a ticket, and then his mum rang him and went, "The ticket was won locally, just like your mum would." And he went, "Well, it's obviously not my ticket," and he's won £1 million. And he had to concentrate on playing in a football match. I mean, fair play to you.
And you're going to say it's my Qatar obsession, but it reminds me of Xavi winning the Qatar Grand Prix. Yes, the lottery, the Qatari lottery was won by Xavi.
Yeah. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely right.
I mean, because with Kevin O'Connor, I was like, he's probably, what's he getting in the championship? I don't know, between 5 and 15 a week, I'm guessing. That's a lot of money, but I don't begrudge him £1 million. Xavi, give it to me. That's what I think. It's the same as I think that when Van Dijk goes for 75 million, I think, can't it be 74 and I get one? Do we want Fitbar Corner? My other Scottish friend, Hoontz, says, "I've been saying Fitbar wrong all this time and I need to say Fitbore." So many apologies to the Scots amongst us. Winter break time now in the Scottish Premiership. They don't return until the 20th of January. I watched the second half of the old firm, Celtic Rangers. It was 0-0, and Rangers absolutely battered Celtic in that game. So I'm going to use that for my knowledge of Scottish football for the next 5 years. Rangers are far better than Celtic and will almost certainly win the league at some point. Second place Aberdeen failed to make up any ground. They were held to a goalless draw at Hearts. Club record of 6 consecutive clean sheets for them. And we were talking about the Jake Livermore story, another awful story. Dunfermline beat Falkirk 2-0. Their midfielder, Dean Shields, he was an Arsenal youth product. He had an eye removed in 2006. He had a childhood injury. It degenerated and an eye removed. He's still playing at this level of football, which, if I understand it rightly, you lose your three-dimensional awareness if you lose an eye. Falkirk fans, some of them threw fake eyeballs onto the pitch. In a previous game, two Falkirk players were suspended for abusing him about losing an eye. You know, what do you want to say? Falkirk have apologised unreservedly in a statement, but it's pretty depressing, isn't it? FA Cup, for the first time, VAR is going to be used in the Palace-Brighton game. Andre Marin as the match referee, Neil Swarbrick, the VAR, and Peter Kirkup, the additional video referee. The key for me with VAR, I don't know about you, is like cricket, like rugby, like tennis, it's got to become part of the entertainment. You've got to hear what they're saying. That's why it works brilliantly in the Ashes. And then you hear the third umpire saying, ball tracking, please. And then I'll move on to hotspot. I'll move on to this. You are part of the process. Yes. From what I've seen, basically everyone just sits around watching on telly or watching in the ground with absolutely no idea what's going on. And then there's another ball's up.
I actually think miking up the referees, well, I mean, you can't obviously ensure the success, but it might be an interesting initiative. But I came across this documentary on YouTube in the 1989-90 season where David Ellery was mic'd up during Millwall Arsenal.
Isn't it brilliant?
And, yes. And Tony Adams calls him a cheat, and there's some very colourful language, and you know, it's interesting. But maybe also miking them up would go a way into maybe ensuring referees are treated with a bit more respect.
I think so.
No, but I think just them explaining their decisions, or just, you know, saying it out loud into
all their decisions, sort of, that happens in rugby and it happens in
American
football.
Yeah, they're the major ones. I mean, if you're giving a penalty, you say, okay, I'm giving it against this player for this offence. And, you know, you would at least get some input from them as to why.
Even if it was a one-way conversation, I don't disagree with you. Liverpool-Everton on Friday night, big game in the FA Cup. Fleetwood-Leicester, Jamie Vardy goes back to his old club. If he's fit, Norwich-Chelsea, Forest-Arsenal. Spain, Diego Costa back and scored for Atletico Madrid on the same night that Morata missed all those chances. First time he'd played since May. So well done, Diego.
There's some great detail in Sid's piece on the Guardian website. I recommend people look it out, because obviously Diego Costa hadn't played in a while and he was a bit overweight when he came back to Madrid, so they put him on this massive pre-season program to get him in fit. Apparently he's lost 8 kilos in a couple of months there, and he's been in boxing in a gym owned by Fernando Torres, and there's loads of amazing stuff. I recommend you seek out that piece on the Guardian website.
Feedback corner and questions on the subject of Plymouth, who we discussed in the last pod, not wanting to play in green because it matched the pitch, and we said, does the pitch have to be green or could they change it? Well, a lot of people got in touch about American sports. Obviously, it's not grass necessarily. Alex Pennington, there's precedent for American college football teams to play on wildly coloured fields. Boise State University is blue. Washington have a vivid orangey red. Central Arkansas, purple and grey stripes. We were talking about English footballing possible prime ministers after George Weah took over Liberia. I mentioned Martin Keown could be our prime minister. The following Saturday on Football Focus, he announced he would run for prime minister. So a new centre-halfist party. That's good news. Yes,
there's also a story recently about how Ronaldinho's apparently supporting a very right-wing candidate in
Bizarre story, that, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very odd, considering...
I wouldn't be too sure that he's aware of who he's supporting. Might have been one of those conversations he has regularly at 4:30 p.m. or a.m., excuse me, and in various places.
Do you want to carry on?
Well, I could.
That's all right.
But I won't.
The best Dean says, with the rise of...
I should take you to the place he used to patronise in Paris one day. It's quite funny.
Do you need ID?
Yeah.
I mean, I have. I mean, I'm over 18. Priya would need ID.
you do. At the entrance there's a little sign which is whatever is said and done here stays here. That's one of those places.
That's basically Lads on Tour.
I'm just not very good at Lads on
Tour.
I'll
tell you more about it off air.
The best Dean says, with the rise of Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain, Trent Alexander-Arnold and Ruben Loftus-Cheek, who's your favourite all-time hyphenated last name double-barrelled 11? And I have thrown this on you, so...
You should have double-barrelled 11.
So we can. I'll tell you, we'll have a minute's thinking time, which we will edit out of the pod.
There's got to be a Wright Phillips in there. You could have a Wright Phillips.
Craig McHale-Smith put in.
Yeah. I think Maitland-Niles is he could be included.
He's a good player as well, isn't
he? He's a very good player indeed.
Fosu-Mensah,
yeah, absolutely.
This is from the sixth metatarsal. Says, after Sachin Nakrani's observation, as Carragher did, that Hector Bellerin's accent sounds nothing like you'd expect to, who's the pod's favourite under this category? I'm a big fan of René Meulensteen's completely unexpected yet brilliant Dutch Cockney accent.
Gattuso.
Speaks Scottish?
Perfect Glaswegian. Ah. Absolutely. It's magnificent.
Is that better
Find
than...
an excerpt of an interview by Gattuso and you will hear him talking in perfect Glaswegian.
Former Rosenborg and Celtic striker Harald Martin Brattbakk also has a bit of a Glaswegian sort of quite nice. He's an airline pilot now, by the way. He's had an interesting post-football career.
I mean, I like Jan Molby's Nordic Scouse. I mean, obviously my favourite is the Irish lilt of Lars Sivertsen. And with that, we'll go.
The pod, Lars is blushing.
Lars, Nick Timothy Sivertsen. I'm really sorry, Lars.
No, shout out to my old friend Egan Richardson for pointing that out. He's completely right, and it's embarrassing.
Sylvain Ebans-Blake.
Ah, yes, Sylvain Ebans-Blake, really good.
Chris Bart Williams. Was that
Chris Bart Williams. Here we go. So look, we'll keep doing this for another 2 hours. Add to it below the line. I'll read some good ones out on Monday. We'll be back then, Priya. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Lars, thank you. Philippe, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.